Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by the Maine Historical Wargamers Association. They're the folks behind Huzzah! Historical Wargaming for New England. Huzzah will take place May 18th through the 20th, 2018, at the Doubletree in South Portland, Maine. Experience some of the best historical wargaming at Huzzah! Visit www.huzzahcon.com for more information. Welcome to Wargaming Recon. I am your host, Jonathan J. Reinhart. Wargaming Recon is the only member of the TSR Podcast Network to discuss historical and New England gaming. This is a very, very special episode 192. We are delighted to say that I have my buddy and co-host, Adrian Benson, with me. Adrian, how are you today?
Hey, John. I'm doing great. Thanks.
And Adrian, I bet you are as enthused as I am because this episode 192 has a very special title because we have an incredible guest that I am delighted to have. The episode is called Sam Mustafa, Game Designer, and we're going to talk about all sorts of stuff on this show. I don't expect you to remember it all. Don't worry. We got show notes. You can find those at wargamingrecon.com/WR192. That's wargamingrecon.com/WR192. So I want to introduce our guest. He is a well-respected historian. He's a professor. He's a published author. But we know and love him best because he's a game designer of a fantastic series of games that we have dived into over many past few years. And we started with Maurice and LaSalle, and we moved forward with Aurelian. And by now, I hope you know who I'm talking about. I'm referring to the one and only Mr. Sam Mustafa. Sam, how are you today?
Hello. Thanks for having me.
I have to say, I am so, so excited that you're here because we've talked about you for, even before Adrian came on the show, which was, what, 3-4 years ago, Adrian?
4 years, I think, yeah.
And we would play your games, and our friends would say, so there's this game designer, you got to like check him out. And so we start playing, and we're like, this is really awesome. And I thought to myself, someday it would be great if I could get him on the show, but I didn't think that would happen. And here you are. So I'm chuffed.
A mere 192 episodes later.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because I don't know how much you know about the show, but the show's been around a long time. It's the longest running tabletop podcast, wargaming podcast in existence. And so
I did know that, yeah.
We do it for just whatever, but it's really come into its own, I would say, within the past 5 to 7 years.
Oddly, about the time I came on board. I don't know if that's related at all.
I don't know. It must be your winning personality. I think that's what it is. People just love seeing you. They're like, that Jonathan guy, forget him. But Adrian, he's who we want. Yeah. So Sam, you've created a whole lineup of games and I know I've missed a few. Why don't you walk us through what some of the games are that you've created?
Sure. I've been doing games. I've been creating games ever since I was a kid. And then in my early 20s, I started self-publishing, you know, in the back in the days of dot matrix printers and excuse me, and, you know, stapled rule books and so on. But most people who know my stuff outside the U.S. would know it from about 2002. And that's when I published a game called Grande Armée. And that was published by Quantum Printing. And then the success of that kind of brought me to a wider audience around the world. And that inspired me to create this game label called Honor. Pardon me. Sorry, I've got water beside the table here in the event of emergencies. sort of about 2005 or so, I've been self-publishing and I've had a small company and I'm basically a one-man show. You know, I've done 8 games under that label and I write, of course, and I stage the playtesting events with the different groups. I handle the layout, the printing, the shipping, everything. I've got people who help me with almost all those things, but essentially I am the business, right? So since I guess it's been about 12 years now, I've been doing that. And if I guess in order, those games would be Might and Reason, LaSalle in 2009, then Maurice, then Longstreet, then Blücher, then Aurelian, then Free Jumper, and as of yesterday, Rommel. Yeah.
Why don't we talk a little bit, actually, to expand on the games that you've done? Why don't we talk a little bit about your game design? How you approach it, your preferences, your game design philosophy, Because all of your games kind of share a core, really. You can take any of them and you see that there's this common thread amongst all of your systems that you've used. And I would say it's a winning formula that you use, but yet they're all very much of their time period and of their conflict. You've done it quite well.
No, thank you. Well, I don't really have a conscious method. I mean, I'm aware that what I do kind of takes a pattern. I guess the first thing I should say is that for every game that gets published, there's probably seven or eight that never do, right? They might only make it, you know, among our friends. We might play it two or three times, say, nah, this isn't working. Or it might work just fine, but it's not a feasible project to invest a lot of money in and time and so on to publish it. But of the ones that do, or I guess just in general, I begin with a theme or a concept, you know, a topic I want to do. And then I think about what kind of playing experience I want. So, for example, I might say, and this is purely conjecture, let's do a game about hunting U-boats in the North Atlantic in World War II. And I want it to be a card game because I want the players to be constantly interacting, playing cards and hunting and searching for each other and things like that. So I begin with some sort of concept like that and with a design experience, or with a playing experience that I want the design to convey. And then from there, it could go anywhere. You know, a lot of the games that do get published end up in a form that's very different from the originally conceived form. You know, Rommel, for example, 2 years ago was a game without any sort of areas, and now it's this area movement game where, you know, the players place terrain and figures and so on in these discrete areas on the board. That was not part of the original design. The original design maybe kind of had cards, doesn't anymore. So a lot of things can change during playtesting, and some of those changes have to do with just whether or not it works, but others have to do with whether or not it's marketable. In the case of Rommel, for example, the dealers were telling me, oh, I don't know if we want to stock cards. Can you do the game without cards? And I thought, well, yeah, actually we could, and went back, and the playtesters liked it better without cards, actually. We came up with some different mechanics. So there's not a set of laws or rules that I go by. I think that if there's a core to these things, in reference to what you said, it's simply that I'm always trying to make whatever subsystem or mechanic of the game as simple as possible. I say this a lot, and I don't know if people are sick of hearing this or if they don't believe me, but it's really, really hard to make something simple. It's easy to design a complicated game. You can just get a whole bucket of things you want in the game and just pour them into a game design, make up a big sequence of play, and they're all in there. That's easy. But to distill the game down to its essential components and to get everything interconnected and as simple as possible, that takes a lot of work. And I'd say 50% to 70% of the playtesting is devoted to that.
Well, I believe that. I mean, it's like when you write, you can write at length, but to really be able to get rid of all that extra stuff that you don't need, that's where a lot of the time or the effort comes in. So it has to be the same way as what you're referring to with your game design.
It is. And I think that because I'm a writer, you know, I write books for a living as well as, you know, designing games and so on. I think probably that helps. I'm a relentless revisionist. You know, I go back and I read the same thing over and over and over. And I do have a ritual in the sense that the morning after I've written something, I spend that morning looking at it again. And often what I thought was brilliant the night before needs to be fixed here and here and here.
So Adrian actually is who I like to refer to as our rules guy, because Adrian, you kind of have this propensity to just absorb rules and their mechanics and kind of dive down deep into them. So when we contacted you, Sam, not doesn't feel that long ago, for us to review Aurelion, I immediately said, okay, got to give it to Adrian. And Adrian, what were your first thoughts about Aurelion when we dived into that?
My first thoughts when I read through the rules, Aurelion is actually a bit different from the game that actually got me hooked on the Honor series was Maurice. I love Maurice. I love the card system, which I'm not a huge fan of card-driven games, I have to be honest. But in Maurice, the card system really does a great job of recreating the command friction. And I love the fact that in a game that's designed around the Seven Years' War period, you can never get all of your troops moving at once, which, of course, they weren't able to do. And most games that simulate that period don't really do a good job of showing that. but Maurice does. Anyway, I love Maurice. That's what got me hooked on the Honor series. But when I read through Aurelian the first time, it's a fair bit different. I mean, just first of all, the fact that there was no dice kind of threw me off. And then reading through the rules, and the way the combat mechanics works, where you can kind of decide based on the card that you play what your combat result is most likely going to be, I was like, I'm not sure I really even want to play this or I'm going to like it. It seemed like everything was kind of sort of going to be predetermined. So John can tell you when we first sat down to play test or review it, I was like, I wasn't totally thrilled with it until we played it. And then it was great. It worked much better than it read, I guess I would say. I really enjoyed the game. We did a few things wrong the first time we played through it. That was John's fault, but
thanks a lot.
He didn't print enough cards. We didn't have enough cards. So the first time we played through it, it was kind of, it didn't work very well. But then the other times were like, I really enjoy the mechanic of deciding what card you're going to play and how the combat result is going to go based on that. It's not at all the way I thought it was going to be. I was like, every time you go into a combat, you're going to know for sure if you're going to win or lose. And you don't, it doesn't play the way it reads.
Yeah, thank you. I did a couple of demos of that game at convention for individual publishers and so on. Back when we were flirting a little bit with having it published as a board game, and I was demoing the game to some publishers, and I didn't tell them there were no dice until after the game is done, and the game plays in about an hour and a half or something like that.
Yeah.
And at the end, I asked for their feedback, and I said, first of all, did you notice there's no dice? And in every single case, they sort of scratch their head and they go, oh, right. there was no dice. And I'm very proud of Aurelian. I think Aurelian is my neglected brilliant child, because it's the least commercially the least successful game I did. I mean, partly because it's only a PDF, right? People don't take a game seriously unless it's got a book. But I knew it was a sort of a small topic, and I didn't want to sink a bunch of money into printing a book.
Yeah.
But it's only played by a couple hundred people in the entire world. But I love it. I think it's a system that's it's got a lot of possibilities, and I haven't totally ruled out the possibility of using it again for some other period.
Yeah.
Because I just love how. That metaphorically, the mechanic is you're running out of luck, right? As the game goes on, you've got these cards with different values, and you can choose to hang on to them or play them. You don't know what the other guy is going to play, so there is some randomization, of course.
Right.
A lot of randomization. But if you do use up your good stuff early, you are literally running out of luck.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an awesome system. I went from like, I'll play it, but I don't want it, to I really love it. So yeah, we'll be playing a lot. I may even go so far as to paint up an army for it. That was one of the big appeals for it was Ancients is it's not really my primary period of interest. I'm more of an American Civil War, Napoleonics, World War II guy. I like Ancients, but I never wanted to invest the money in miniatures and the time in painting them. But then we had the opportunity to give this a shot, and it's like, all right, we'll give it a try. But now I love it. It's a great game. I'm surprised that it's not more popular than you say it is. I mean, it is a fairly narrow topic.
Right. I think a lot of Ancients games, maybe even all of them, with just a few exceptions, they tend to cover this period from Moses to Columbus. You know, there's this vast array of possible armies. You can, and in many of those games, they're sort of indifferent to historical or geographic matchup. You know, you could have your Egyptians fighting Vikings, or your Henry VIII versus the samurai, or something like that. Whereas Aurelian picks about 80 years of history and just zeroes in on that. And I think people assumed that, well, you know, I don't have any Sassanid Persians or, you know, Middle Romans or whatever, therefore it's not for me. But of course, that's why I gave them the unit cards as well. You know, you can just, you don't need miniatures. You can plop down the unit cards and play with those.
Exactly.
The last time I played it, in fact, we didn't use, I have miniatures for it, but we didn't use them. We just, because I was traveling at the time, and I met up with some gamers who are friends of mine in Berlin, and we just plopped it right down and played, and I won. I almost never win that game.
No, that's funny. Adrian, you kind of surprised me, though, saying that you might want to paint up minis for it, because for me, part of the appeal is that you don't need minis. And in fact, I have 172nd scale Ancient Romans, and I'm getting rid of them in part because of Aurelian, because I'm like, the unit tiles are so good, and for me, there's no need to have the minis for this game. And it actually kind of reminds me, way back, I think it was 2014, Sam, you wrote a column for War Game Soldiers and Strategy magazine. And you talked about how, not that I expect you to remember, but at the time you talked about how you kind of surprised in your gaming circle at how few people are painting miniatures, including people who are longtime painters. And I remember reading that column of yours and thinking, this is something I need to talk about. So we actually talked about it, used you as inspiration, talked about it on an episode of the show 113, where I posited the question, are painted minis essential to miniatures wargaming? And I came out and said, no, that they're not essential, which was very controversial, as you can imagine, and probably maybe is with you as well. But I love that how I think probably at the time you were doing the column, you may have been thinking about doing Free Jumper and Aurelion. And I might be wrong on the timeline.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about doing Bleacher.
Oh, really? Okay.
So yeah. Bleacher was the first game that I did that had the unit cards. And specifically because I think in that column I referenced Horse and Musket, I think of not just Napoleonics, but I was talking about the trend of games to go down to a sort of skirmish level where you only need a few dozen figures and to play in a very small table. And I said for people like me who are really interested in the Horse and Musket period, that's kind of a non-starter. I mean, there's only so much skirmishing you can do in the Seven Years' War, and you don't really want to play, you know, a big Horse and Musket game with 20 figures on the table. It would look ridiculous trying to do Waterloo with 20 figures. So I was pondering, what if you were to flip this around? You know, many games have lots of figures and then a few markers. What if you were to have lots of markers and a few figures? You could have a really gorgeous figure to be Wellington or Napoleon or whatever, and then some sort of marker, like a board game, could stand in for the figures. And if you do that, you could lower the bar to entry for a new player. And one of the things that puts off new players in Horse and Musket is just how many figures they have to buy and paint in a really fancy way, right? To look good, Horse and Musket figures take a lot of investment and a lot of work. So what if you could introduce unit cards instead, and just have literally in your hand an army, throw it down in 5 minutes, and that's what I did. So in some ways, the accessories to Bleacher have sold better than the game itself, because people use them not just for Bleacher, but for other Napoleonic games.
Yeah,
I can believe it. With Aurelion, I thought the same thing. I was like, well, do you know, we'll use the unit tiles, and we'll use it actually for another Ancients war game, and we'll just use that, because we won't actually have to paint the minis that Adrian, you bought, and I have. We'll just use these, and then we actually started looking, and we're like, forget that. Let's play the game. And so we asked you about the game, and then we played the game, and I love how deceptively simple it is. Because Adrian, like you said, you look at it and you think, okay, this is what you got to do, but you don't really know. Like looking right at the, that's why I think it's so important when people play games and they look at rules and stuff. Before they start sprouting off opinions, you need to actually play the game. You can't just look at the rules and be like, okay, I read the rules once, and this is what it means. Well, no, you don't know what it means. Like, get at the table and play, and play a few times, and then see what you think it means.
Yeah, I'm not going to name names, but I don't need the fingers. I don't need the fingers of one hand to count the number of reviews I've gotten from someone who played the game. Right? I mean, almost all the written reviews I've received in magazines and so on are just from somebody flipping through the book.
Oh, yeah, that's... Yep.
I was going to offer two things, if I may, real quickly, about just things that I love in games and things that I try to do in game design in general. One is to emphasize the different kinds of randomness that you can have. Many people, I think, design games or play games in which everything is known except the die roll.
Yeah.
So you know exactly when your next phase for shooting is. You know exactly what the sequence is, when the enemy can do this. You know exactly how far you can move in the trees and whatever. And then, to give it a little bit of randomness, we throw a die roll on at the end of that process. I love trying to inject randomness into every aspect of the game without clunking up the game if possible, which brings me to the second point, and that is, if you can try to have the players constantly interacting in the sequence, or better yet, with no sequence at all, you know, let them decide by interrupting and modifying and whatever and playing their opportunities against each other, then natural randomness takes over. Because, yes, I know you've got cards, and I can even look over there and see you've got four and I've got six, so I know I've got more than you, but I don't know what you've got, and I don't know what you've got in mind. I don't know, you may have a tremendous card, but you don't want to use it, but I have no way of knowing that. So just because I have an opponent, and I can't know what he's going to do, there's randomness. Therefore, the more interaction you have between the players, the less that you chain them to a sequence, the more randomness the game has. And that's why in Aurelion, for example, Because we're constantly interrupting each other, and because I don't know what you're going to do next or how you're going to modify it or how many actions you're going to take and so on, even with no dice whatsoever, there's tons of random.
Yeah. Yeah, there was. And it was very refreshing. Like I said, I was expecting a completely predetermined outcome with not a whole lot of tactical options. And both of those opinions were completely wrong. So
I got to say, well, I wasn't completely surprised, because I thought to myself, Adrian, you have to be wrong, because, and you're going to think I'm just saying it in brown nose, but it's true. At the time, I thought, okay, Sam has created a bunch of games and they're very popular. So if this was all it was, he wouldn't be having the success that he has. So there has to be something we're missing. And I didn't know what it was, but I knew there had to be something more. And I was like, but maybe I'm wrong, because I've been wrong many times in my life and will be again. And so I know, feel free to chime in here. So I thought, okay, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt, Adrian, and let's just play. Let's play the game and we'll see. And we'll get to the table. And I'm glad we did. We played many times, which is my kind of unofficial rules for anything we're going to do and talk about on the show, especially a review. Like, I really want us to throw ourselves at it and see how it is. And so I think we played Aurelion more than we played any other one single game system in the past, 6 months or a year?
Well, except possibly Bold Action. But we played it a lot.
Thank you. Weeknight, thank too. You, Jonathan. I do reserve the right to screw up from time to time. But I will say that I'm always amused that people ask me, was this play tested? What do you think?
No, I just banged it out and threw it out there. Yeah.
You wanted to throw that money at it and put it out, knowing it might not be great, and just see what happened. That is funny. But people, they feel free to tell you anything. They really do. Good, bad, whatever. You get it all, I'm sure.
I have to be careful, because among my friends, I do share sort of the Wargamer's greatest hits album of crazy things people say to me or ask me, or sometimes just incredibly stupid things that I get thrown at me in emails and whatnot. And I really probably shouldn't broadcast those in case the guy who just wrote it 10 minutes ago is watching your podcast.
We did a thing once about, and I tell you, we got more feedback about that than anything else. So we did an episode, and we told people ahead we wanted feedback for this or content on pet peeves that listeners have about game conventions. Yeah. And I tell you, I had to edit and redact a lot of stuff, because there was like, so-and-so does this, and at this convention, and I don't want to embarrass anyone, but like the core concept was important. So I'd be like, sometimes at conventions, This might happen, and don't do that. You get a generalize. But it was funny. And we're still getting comments from people about things that we should do, like a part two and part three, because we get some. You could do a whole series, you could do a whole series on the things people tell you.
Yeah, there's apparently quite a few pet peeves out there. Who knew?
You could probably do a game, Sam, just of all the ways that people think your game should be played, and like a parody kind of game. And I bet it would sell well.
Well, once you buy the game, it's yours, right? And I tell people this all the time: do whatever you want. You paid your money; it's your toy. Play with it however you want. You will not break my heart. what baffles me, and I get this often actually, someone will flip through it once, not having yet played it, or maybe play a turn or two, and then print this long jeremiad or send me an email about how everything is wrong and how it really needs to be changed to this. And start this long thread on the website, and I've never known what exactly they expect me to do. I mean, do you really expect me to say, "Oh my God, Jonathan, Eureka"? I mean, stop the presses, return all the books now. I'm going to officially amend the rules to make sure that your suggestion is now official. And because I have such power, spreading around the world, I can mandate that everyone now play it the way that you want to. Right? What are they thinking? I always respond by saying, "Well, play however you like," and that's not the answer they want to hear. No. They want to hear me say, "Wow, you're right. I'm officially changing the game as of now based on your suggestion." It happens every single time.
If only I were as brilliant as you, then I too could be a great game designer. I'm sorry, that's a little, but I know what you mean. It's hard trying to figure out the proper way to respond to that kind of stuff. And you put yourself out there, right? You make all your games, you do all the stuff, and you write and everything. So you're getting it from every which way of people saying they like it, they don't, and they unload. And I always say that constructive criticism is great, but it has to be constructive.
Yeah, and when you get that, those are the guys you want to hire as playtesters.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, for the next one. and many of the playtesters are guys who gave me some grief about a previous game, and I thought, this guy is smart. This guy has some good observational skills. Let's recruit this guy. Yeah.
Why don't we talk a little bit about your so-called next game, which really is the next because it just came out, Rommel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you had alluded to it earlier that Rommel's very different, not just because of how it morphed in game design, but you have this whole area effect kind of game. Why don't you explain a little bit about Rommel? Because I'm sure not all of our listeners are familiar with the game, although they should be. And just a little bit about why you created it and how it works and how they can get their hands on it.
Sure. So I've always liked World War II as a gaming period, like I guess most people. But I'm not a huge skirmish gamer guy. I mean, for me, having just a handful of figures on the table is sort of unsatisfying. And I'm not that good at tactics. So, I'm not the guy you want to ask, how should we best take the church steeple and knock out that German MG42? I don't know. So I've always wanted a bigger scale World War II game. And there, if you think about it, typically that's something for board games, right? I mean, there are very few miniatures or tabletop operational scale World War II games. I think I could name maybe two in the past quarter century. Yeah. So I've always known I wanted to do that. It got delayed by other projects for a while. It had a different name for a while. And some of the early playtest versions didn't work very well. But I finally decided that in 2016, this was the year I was going to do it. And that's when we began working on it. And it became obvious pretty quickly that it needed to be area-based. There's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, when you're doing relatively large scale, I guess any scale World War II gaming, you need some way to show combined arms operations. You need to do so in a way that's different from horse and musket. In the horse and musket period, combined arms is about different branches of the army being in proximity to one another. The infantry is here, the cavalry is nearby, the artillery is firing in support, but they're not really intermixed. Yeah. But in World War II, they are. You can easily imagine that company of infantry being supported by a platoon of tanks, for example, or those self-propelled anti-aircraft guns in Normandy moving along the column with the German tanks in case the Allied fighters jump them or something like that. So that's hard to do in a traditional tabletop game where you've got rulers and open tabletop because the figures have to be somewhere on the table, right? And if you're going to have an infantry base and a tank base representing an infantry unit and an armor unit, you could put them side by side, I suppose, one on the left and one on the right. But then what happens if the infantry base is partially in the woods, but the tank isn't? If you attack that unit, which one are you attacking? Are you attacking them both? And if so, does that mean the tank is also in the woods, even though he's not really in the woods? It's really hard. You have to write a zillion rules to cover what it really means to be mixed together as a single unit, unless you have areas. So it just worked really well to have an area-based game at this scale where an area is basically 1 kilometer means that whatever you put in that area is a combined arms team just by definition. That's the terrain. There's no debate as to what terrain they're in. It's right there. There's no debate as to who is in what kind of terrain. Everybody in that area is in that terrain. There's no question as to what the attacker is doing. If he's attacking you, he must also be in that terrain. Now, 1 kilometer is a pretty good engagement distance. Even for tank guns, it's kind of long distance for the, just the limits of the human eyeball at that range. And then there's no issues with things like, am I being flanked? Well, the right fender of the Sherman tank is just across the front line. So you're kind of being flanked, but maybe not. There's none of that. There's no question where an artillery barrage lands. It's in that area, nowhere else. There's no putting down a template and saying, well, I can pivot it this way and squeeze one more of your mortar bases under the template. There's no question where an airstrike is happening. There's no question where the supplies are coming from. There's no question where your headquarters is. So areas simplify the game massively. It takes another 5 to 10 minutes to set up at start because if you don't have something with areas already marked, you need some little pebbles or something. Just put little pebbles to make corners, and that takes about 5 or 10 minutes. Once you do, it shaves about an hour off the playing time because you don't need to measure anything. You just count the areas. Artillery ranges become very simple and very straightforward. Where you can move is super simple. It's a remarkable streamlining that allows us to put the detail of the game elsewhere. the way board games often do. And for those people who are sort of tabletop game and miniatures game purists who think, board game, I've got board games in my closet. If I wanted to play a board game, I'd play a board game. Well, so what? You're playing a game, right? Games have playing pieces. Games have a surface. I really don't care personally whether that playing piece is a counter or a miniature. I use whatever looks good with the game I'm playing. I'm agnostic when it comes to what my playing piece is. But the experience of the game matters a lot to me. Is it fun to play? Is it challenging? Does it feel good? And so I want the best possible experience, and I am not above stealing from board games or stealing from anything to make a nice hybrid like that.
Yeah, I'm kind of excited about Rommel because, I mean, you're right. I can't really think of any operational level World War II games. I guess the only one that might be available right now, I'm not super familiar with it. I've never read it or anything, but there's a series of games called Battle Group, like Battle Group Kursk, Battle Group. Mm-hmm. That might be the only other kind of example.
No, they're skirmish games. They're very small.
Oh, they are?
Yeah, one vehicle is one tank.
Well, then I can't think of any.
Yeah.
I'm more of a skirmish and maybe company level style gamer myself, but this one, yeah, I'm excited about this one. There actually aren't that many operational level miniatures games of any period. I mean, there's a few for Napoleonics, maybe one or two for Horse and Musket, Seven Years' War, but not that many. So it's kind of an interesting thing to bring to the miniatures tabletop. Not a lot of people even try it.
Yeah, we do one unit is roughly a company in Rommel.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I say roughly to hedge my bets because, you know, if you're playing Eastern Front in 1944, for instance, it's probably a battalion because both sides have such manpower shortages by that point. And, you know, it's probably a company that's also been reinforced. It's probably got some anti-tank guns. It's probably got some anti-aircraft guns and some mortars and, you know, heavy weapons platoon or something like that.
Yeah. So
somewhere between 100 and 200 men is a unit. And that allows you, if you've got, you know, I don't know, two or three guys on a side in some big space and a, you know, a big table or a convention or whatever, you could do a really serious battle at that scale. You know, you could, we did about half of Market Garden just during playtesting, you know, the American part of the corridor. But you could do the Normandy landings. There's nothing preventing you. One of the playtest scenarios we did, which I'll probably put up for free on the web soon, is Juno Beach. So, you know, we did the whole Canadian landing at Juno Beach and the counterattack of the 21st Panzer Division and all of that. And you could do that in 2 hours. That's a walk in the park.
That would be great. Either flank of Kursk, you could probably do with that scale. It would be great. Yeah, that would be great. So I haven't ordered it yet, but if I can get on the website today, I'm going to. So
website's fixed. my customers crashed the website yesterday, but it's fixed.
That's a great problem to have. I mean, not that you want it to happen, but like because people love your stuff so much that they're flooding you. That's pretty cool.
Well, it was a hair-raising 4 hours on customer support, that's for sure.
No doubt.
So for the game, just correct me if I'm wrong, for the playing surface, it's something that works best with a gridded or hexed surface?
In the advanced game, there's some provisions for using hexes, if you prefer.
Okay.
But I didn't want to mandate hexes because relatively few people have a hex grid tabletop surface available. And if I said you've got to use hexes, I'd drive off 90% of the customers. Anybody can make squares. All you do is you lay out your green cloth on the table and take some pebbles from your backyard and make corners out of them. Right? You put every 6 inches, you put a pebble, and within 5 minutes later, you've got a square table grid.
So like I have a bunch of cigar box battle mats because I love their stuff and they are just amazing people. But none of them have any sort of grid on it. So like you said, I could just go get pebbles, get twigs, whatever, pieces of paper and just kind of put that in and you're okay. Like you don't need anything fancy done in order to.
Sure. And by the way, Cigar Box does now have Rommel mats.
They do.
I did see that.
Yeah. They announced them yesterday on their website, and two of them are in the photos of the book, a 4-inch square and a 6-inch square version, so you can scale up or scale down the game if you want to go really big. For Market Garden, we did 4-inch squares, so we can have that long road corridor.
Yeah.
But you don't have to do corners. You could do terrain features, for example. If you imagine a square that has a center point, right? Imagine drawing an X from the corners, right? And in the center point, put something, a tree, for instance, that's a wooded square. Or put a little house, that's an urban square. Or just put a rock and that's an open square. So you can do it without any, if grids offend your eyes, you can use terrain pieces instead and just move from terrain piece to terrain piece.
That's pretty cool. And for this, are you recommending that people use minis? Are you suggesting print and play kind of models, unit tiles? Like, what's the general feeling for that?
Well, we did play tests with both. It depends on how much time we had to set up. You know, I'm taking the game to a local hobby store in a couple of weeks, and I'm going to bring miniatures, obviously, because they look cool. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have time, you know, most of the time spent in miniatures games is setting up miniatures and then taking down miniatures. You can just print off the unit cards and play with them as playing pieces. And when we were pressed for time during playtest, we did that a lot. We had a big North Africa game, Brits versus Italians in 1940. And we just didn't bother. I didn't have that many Italian figures, and nobody in our group did. So we just played with the unit cards. However, I've sized the cards to be about 2 inches wide. So if you have 15 millimeter World War II figures, and a lot of guys do for popular games like, you know, Battle Group or Flames of War or whatever, then they fit right under those bases and can stick out like a label. So all you need to know is what you're looking at. This company is guys in half tracks belongs to the 21st Panzer Division or whatever. You need to know that in some way. And if you don't feel like marking your figure bases or trying to remember them all in a big game, just use the unit cards as labels like we did in Blücher.
Yeah.
That's pretty sweet. And I think I found a new use for my Flames of War models.
Oh, well, you know, I assume I'm a Flames of War player. I have been for years, ever since first edition. And I assume that a lot of guys who would try Rommel had armies about that size. So if you've got what Flames of War calls an army is already a reinforced company. Right. Mm-hmm. It's a company with lots of extra gadgets and doodads because they're cool, because you know, you got to have a flame throwing tank or whatever.
Absolutely.
But if you've got a force of that size, like, for example, I have a German Panzer Grenadier force for Flames of War. Mm-hmm. I think everyone does. Now I've got a Panzer Division, right? That in Rommel scale, that is the 17th Panzer Division. Hmm.
That's pretty cool.
That's awesome. Yeah. Yeah, we've each got armies for Flames of War. I haven't played Flames of War in quite a while, but yeah, definitely been looking for use for those. We've done some other company level games, but yeah, I'm looking forward to giving this one a try.
Yeah, I have a Panzer company, and it's been sitting there because I love painting the models, but just I kind of moved away from the game, and I was like, what should we do? And we talked about Chain of Command. Was that one of the ones we were talking about, Adrian?
I Ain't Been Shot, Mom. I've played that a lot. Yeah. That's actually a really fun company level World War II game, but yeah.
But this sounds delightful. How can people get their hands on it? You mentioned your website. Is that sammustafa.com?
Yeah, one word, sammustafa.com. If you are in faraway parts of the world from me, we have retailers in down under. We got Eureka Miniatures in Australia, and also covers New Zealand, of course. Black Hat Miniatures and North Star Miniatures in the UK. I'll ship anywhere in the world, but from the website. But if you prefer to go to a local dealer, you can check out those guys. And I'm filling some other dealer orders in over the weekend. So you should be getting messages from your miniatures and gaming dealer of choice. If you're on their mailing list, they'll probably send you a blurb this week with Rommel in it.
And unit tiles, are you doing those online, like through drive-through cards like you had in the past?
No, I haven't done them yet. right now, I've given there's a free template I'm giving away on my website as a DIY, so you can make your own. Rommel is very open architecture. I did this a bit in Blücher, but I've really done it in Rommel, so that if you want to change the game parameters, you can. Or if you want to create a new army, for example, there's no Romanian army list for Rommel, right? But if you really love the Romanians in World War II, everything you need in the book is there to create a Romanian army. It'll fit right into the 14 army lists that are there. And then you just download those DIY unit cards and you could stat up your Romanians. And there you go.
Excellent.
Wow. Why don't we move on to one of my favorite parts of the show, which is our feed mailbag section where we do all feedback. And so we got some feedback on Facebook. Listener Tim said of episode 189, the Great Wargaming Survey 2017 with Jasper Ortiz, he said, quote, "I make sure I take the survey every year. It's important to have your opinions in the mix as publishers and manufacturers pay attention to the results," unquote. Tim, I want to thank you for your feedback. And Sam, as a publisher and a manufacturer, so to speak, have you taken, are you aware of the Great Wargaming Survey? Mm-hmm. And do you look at the results?
I haven't looked this year. I looked last year, and I can't remember what year I participated. I think it was 2 years ago that I filled it out. So yeah, I'm definitely aware of it. Yeah.
I think it's a great thing that they do over there at WSNS, and not just for them, obviously, because it helps them to know what they should focus on as a magazine, and print has a lot of difficulties in when it comes to publishing. But I think it's really good for all of us as a wargaming community to be aware of what's out there. And so you might be someone who wants to get into the hobby, and you don't really know what you're likely to find for people insofar as games. So if you look at the Great Wargaming Survey, you can see that generally in your particular country or your area, people might like to play a certain era or a certain style of play. So then you can look at that and see if that is something that interests you, and then see if there are people in your more local area that you can do that with. It's a really great service, and I'm delighted that so many people participate in it. We also have a bit of feedback also on Facebook from listener Jay, who also commented about the same episode of the Great Wargaming Survey 2017. He said, quote, "Started listening to the episode today. Thanks for the shout out. Wargaming Recon is one of the inspirations for the veteran wargamer. Glad you enjoy it," unquote. So Jay, thank you also for writing in. And Jay is Jay Arnold. He's the host of the Veteran Wargamer. It's a fantastic podcast. One of the very few wargaming podcasts that I regularly listen to. Oddly enough, for a podcaster, I don't listen to a whole lot of podcasts, and I don't listen to a whole lot of gaming podcasts, but his is one of the ones that I do, and I suggest people check him out. And Sam, I don't know if you're familiar with the show, but it's worth a listen.
No, I'm going to be talking to him in a couple weeks, actually.
Oh, wonderful. Oh,
awesome.
Yeah.
It's interesting how for a long time there hadn't been so many wargaming or even gaming podcasts, but then there's been a lot more, and I feel that it's spread out so that we're really kind of focusing on more hyper-local stuff. So you get people popping up in different states or in different provinces in different countries, and they might do a little bit of global stuff, but then they really focus in on what is the gaming life in South Africa, what is the gaming like in China or wherever, and so they can kind of get at that. So there's more of us, and I think it just makes everyone stronger. As they say, a rising tide lifts all boats. So it's pretty neat, and I think you're gonna have a great time on the show. We're gonna be going on sometime in September, but I'm not quite sure when, but there's going to be a group of us, I think, and it should be a lot of fun. He runs a good show.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
And then we just have a few announcements to share with everyone. I want to remind everyone about our Facebook group. You can get the link to that in the show notes. Just kind of a place for people to hang out, kind of like, Sam, like your bulletin board that you have online. And instead of doing that, we have a Facebook group so people can just kind of chat, anything gaming. They can talk about stuff with the show and all that kind of things. We just have all sorts of different discussions going on there. So I think people will enjoy that. And we have an update about the Roku channel. So for those of you who don't know, we are also part of the Nerd Broadcasting Network, which is going to bring video to the masses. And so we're starting off with the Roku channel, and they're working on that. There's some funding and grants that's coming in, just taking a little bit longer for that to happen. So things are being delayed, and they're hoping by winter of 2017 that the Roku channel will be out, and then you'll be able to see me on your TV. I don't know why you want to look at me, but you might. You want to look at Sam. You want to look at him instead. Look at Adrian instead of me.
So, I definitely want to look at me.
Yeah, absolutely. So you'll see that, and we'll have all sorts of content on there. We'll be doing the show, so you'll be able to see interviews like this. You'll be able to see reviews. We'll do how-tos and tutorials and actual play content and all of that kind of stuff. So that should be pretty neat. And when we have more information, we will release that to you. You can also help support the show by becoming a member of the Wargaming Recon Army. You can go to Patreon to do that. WargamingRecon.com/Patreon. Costs as little as $1 per month. And I want to thank some of our Wargaming Recon Army members, Patrick and Kyle from Vermont, for your support and being part of the community. If you become a member, you get episodes before non-members, you get exclusive content, and then there's all sorts of other rewards. We do things like special Wargaming Recon dice, and we have gift things that are coming out, kind of like a loot crate sort of stuff. We t-shirts and just all sorts of stuff, so you can check that out there and see all that. And then I want to remind you all also about the show notes, wargamingrecon.com/WR192. That'll have all the things we talked about and links and everything. And Sam, before we end the episode, how can people stay in touch with you? How can they buy all your games and just see what all new stuff is that you're going to be working on?
So my website is sammustafa.com. I also have a Facebook page, Sam Mustafa Publishing, LLC. I have a personal Facebook page, but the announcements, you know, come from usually from the business page. I do have a forum, or I will on Monday, hopefully, when we fix that. It died in the website crash when the customers crashed the website yesterday, and there's some compatibility problem on the database. I can't get it fixed till Monday. So actually, it's been a blessing in disguise. I haven't had to answer a bunch of questions there because I've been packing like crazy for the orders. But we'll have the forum back up from the homepage of my website. You just click on forum, and it'll take you to that. Yep. And then if you want, you can get on the mailing list. That's done for every person who buys a game, unless they check the box saying, no, don't put me on the mailing list. But you can also just contact me from the bottom of the website.
Fantastic. I would encourage people to do all of those things. And I want to say that it's been a delight to have you on the show, Sam. And
no, thank you.
I hope we can have you back. We'll find a reason after we play Rommel.
If we play Rommel,
yeah. Which... And since we're on the topic of Rommel and podcasting, can I just do one other suggestion for listeners? Please. If you want, I do podcasts as well, audio podcasts, and the last three have been about Rommel, including a how to play. And if you want to sort of check the game out and walk through the rules, the second of those three podcasts is called How to Play Rommel. Go to the website, and you can download the gadgets free. And you can sort of walk with me through the sequence of play and walk with me through a sample scenario. And we talk about how to go through what the scales mean and so on, and how to go through the numbers of the game. And it's about 20 minutes, and you can get a good sense of how to play the basic game. Really, you should be able to play the game from that moment with the gadgets for free and the podcast.
Awesome.
Yeah, we'll have a link to that in the show notes. So you should definitely check that out. I know I will, because I'm very intrigued by the game and excited that it's here. And it'd be nice to get a little bit of how-to from you, Sam, as creators before we dive in. Maybe it'll prevent me from making my normal mistakes when I get into a new game.
No.
No, probably not, but I can hope. Well, thank you again, Sam, for being on this episode of Wargaming Recon.
Thanks for the invite. I appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure, really. And I want to thank all awesome. Our listeners for taking the time out of their very busy schedules to listen to this episode of Wargaming Recon. Remember, no matter how busy you are, no matter what you're doing, no matter how much time you want to spend painting figures for Rommel, you know that you need to keep on gaming. Are you always on the go? Why not take Wargaming Recon with you? If you use an app like Pocket Casts, you can listen to your favorite episodes of Wargaming Recon on your mobile device. Wargaming Recon is a proud member of the TSR Podcast Network. Visit wargamingrecon.com/TSRPN for more information and to learn about the other good shows on the network. This recording is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. Many thanks to Andrew and Court for inspiring the show's name. Wargaming Recon is dedicated to the memory of longtime listener Andrew. I ask all listeners to join me in a moment of silence in memory of Andrew. Wargaming Recon is made possible by listeners like you. Become a Patreon backer to get behind-the-scenes content and new episodes before everyone else, starting at $1 per month. Visit wargamingrecon.com/Patreon to become a Patreon backer. Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by the Maine Historical Wargamers Association. They're the folks behind Huzzah! Historical Wargaming for New England. Huzzah will take place May 18th through the 20th, 2018, at the Doubletree in South Portland, Maine. Experience some of the best historical wargaming at Huzzah! Visit www.huzzahcon.com for more information.